Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. And welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Richard Campanella, whose new book is Cityscapes of New Orleans. We'll also hear from Susan Tucker and Lee Grew about their wonderful anthology Mending for Memory, Sewing in Louisiana, Essays, Stories, and Poems. And I'll have a preview of the Louisiana Book Festival. We always learn something when we look at New Orleans through the eyes of Tulane professor Richard Campanella. He's the author of 8 books about the city, including Bourbon Street, A History, Bienville's Dilemma, and Geographies of New Orleans. He's been honored with the Humanities Book of the Year Award from the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the Louisiana Library Association's Literary Award, and the Williams Prize for Louisiana History. Today, we're talking about his new book, Cityscapes of New Orleans. Rich Campanella, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
I love these little get-togethers. Now, one of the most important things that I've learned from you over the years is that you can read New Orleans like a book, which is what you do. So what was it like for you to collect all these writings from Preservation in Print, Louisiana Cultural Vistas, and the Times-Picayune, NOLA.com? What was it like for you to look at this work in its entirety?
Well, I should point out that it's a reader. It's like a single author anthology of about 75 or so shorter pieces that I've been working on for the past decade, whereupon I took on writing for a number of Louisiana Cultural Vistas, Cityscapes column in the Picayune, Preservation in Print, and I pulled together a number of contributions I've also made to academic journals. But what all holds them together is space and place. So I identify, characterize, and try to explain spatial patterns through the dimension of time, and thus the use of the word cityscapes in the title. And you could think of a cityscape as sort of the total accumulation of manipulations to a certain area made by human agents representing different cultural groups and different cultural eras in an area of high human density. And so when you go step outside, everything in your visible domain, the layout of the streets, the soils and the biota, the shapes of the buildings, the people in the public space. And so what I try to do and what I try to teach is to look at those signatures and back out their antecedents.
Right. And you want to complicate the way we look at the city. You want it to be a rich and in-depth
look. It does the complicating.
Yes, I guess it does, really.
I try to clarify it.
You have work cut out for you.
Keeps me busy.
Now, you write a lot about some fascinating vanished things, like Leland University.
Yes.
That's one thing that fascinates me.
I guess it's intrinsic that if you're a historical geographer, a lot of what you study are things that are vanished. Mm-hmm. But again, they leave on their vestiges and relics in the cityscape that affect us. So when I move about town, I look at different spaces and places, and I probably see a city different than most other folks because I see an empty parking lot over there, and I remember the old shot tower. And I look over here, and I remember old Chinatown, and I look at that corner just off Newcomb Boulevard and St. Charles Avenue and realized that the first institution of higher learning in what is now Uptown New Orleans was not Tulane or Loyola, it was Leland University.
So fascinating. I often wish I could see New Orleans through your eyes, but sometimes I think I do. But I think that's the nature of this city, to have the past shimmer through at us in those kinds of ways.
This phenomenon, of course, is not unique to New Orleans.
Right.
There are other old cities that accumulate these layers. But for a variety of reasons, one being that this used to be the largest city in the South, the third largest in the nation, and there was a lot of activity here, a lot of connections and constructions relating it to the rest of the world. And then we were blessed to have had an early and very effective preservation movement that has retained a lot of these elements of the built environment. And, you know, just the other day, I took some of my students and we went for a walk through Audubon Park. The ability to sit under an oak tree that has been a living witness to the entire adventure here over the past 300 years is something that we should really relish.
Oh, absolutely. And you also write about such wonderful architectural gems as the French Opera House and the Ursuline Nuns' Third Convent.
The Third Convent. Ah. We all know the second one. The first one is long lost. The second one is the oldest, fully documented, fully intact building, not just in the city, but in the entire Lower Mississippi Valley at 1111 Charters. But after the Lower French Quarter became quite dense and congested, it became understood that this was not the place for this sort of spacious, low-density operation. And so the sisters moved downriver to what is now the opening of the mouth of the Industrial Canal. And from the 1820s to the 19-teens, they had this beautiful, almost old-world compound there. And you look at pictures of it, and it looks like the French countryside.
Oh, the pictures are stunning. And the whole idea that travelers on the river would see their clock.
They would see this Baroque clock, and it would be one of these landmarks that would signal that you're approaching New Orleans. And of course, in the distance, you would see the domes of the hotels, plumes of smoke, you would hear the activity, and it must have been an exciting place.
So what would you see from the past if you could see anything?
Oh, I would love to walk around Chinatown.
I knew it.
And we mentioned the old Shot Tower earlier. This was the tallest building in the city for 20 years, right around the turn of the 19th to 20th century. And it was a bit of a bizarre building, but it was almost thrilling in its pragmatic, brilliantly simple idea that if you build a high tower with a steam elevator and you bring lead up to the top and then you melt it, if you drop it through a sieve, those little globules, those little drops of molten lead solidify as they make this free fall down 200 feet. And they capture them in a bucket, and suddenly you have birdshot or grape shot that you could sell. So it was local heavy industry made by gravity. So this was on St. Joseph Street in what is now the Warehouse District, not too far from where the Children's Museum is now. And during slack times when they weren't making much shot, they would open it up for tourism. And it actually in 1885, during the World's Fair at Audubon Park, you'd be able to go up there and see the sites.
And you bring it all up to the very present. You talk about the origins of go-cups.
Go-cups, very significant in my earlier study on Bourbon Street. What distinguishes the Bourbon Street of the mid-20th century from the late 20th century and the Bourbon Street we know today is the geography of the action. Prior to the 1960s, the action was behind closed doors. There was a doorman. There were velvet curtains. It was fancy, high-end burlesque places. They were also being subsidized by an artificial stream of corrupt money through gambling and beer drinking scams. After the Jim Garrison crackdowns of the 1960s, that profit margin is now shrunk. The subsidies and from organized crime are no longer coming in. And so Bourbon Street has to reinvent itself by the late 1960s. At the same time that these big corporate hotels are being built there, the Royal Sonesta, the Bourbon Orleans, et cetera. And so one unremembered venue comes up with a clever idea. This is around 1968, 67, right around the hippie era, when there's a new clientele, shall we call them, coming to Bourbon Street. And it's not people on hot dates dressed to the nines. It's hippies. So the idea was, instead of cajoling people in the public space to come indoors to see a show they don't want to pay for and pay high price for drinks, why not open up little apertures, windows and doors, and sell inside drinks to folks outside? And it was originally called window hawking. And the idea was a hit. It made drinks cheaper. It reduced overhead costs. There was no air conditioning. You didn't have to hire dancers. And so selling drinks out into the street transferred the action on Bourbon from the private space into the public space. Thus was born the pedestrian parade. Thus was born the nightly cavalcade of people with drinks in hands. So the portability of alcohol is what really completely transformed Bourbon Street. So the to-go cup is to-go. That means
exactly.
That means mobility. It means spatial mobility.
Go and look and see.
Yeah.
And the other thing you write about so wonderfully is, you know, if the Saints are losing, don't blame the Girard Street Cemetery.
There's a rumor afoot that the Superdome was built right on the Gerrard Street Cemetery. It's actually just offset a bit. It aligns more with Champion Square. And you know that underpass? You go under the old Macy's. So as you enter that little tunnel, the Gerrard Street Cemetery, laid out in 1822, starts there and goes at an angle across Champion Square and into that parking garage. There was a little bit of an extension that came a little bit closer to the Superdome. It was eventually deconsecrated and removed in the mid to late 1950s as part of the street widening and urban renewal project of the Morrison era that in part led to the creation of the new City Hall, the widening of Loyola Avenue, but in the case of the cemetery, the widening of LaSalle Street. And we barely have a memory of a LaSalle Street there, but it's one of the most utterly transformed areas and one of the most fascinating. Louis Armstrong was born a couple of blocks away. The New Basin Canal was a couple of blocks away, and Chinatown was a couple of blocks away.
Wow, that's your spot.
That's where I want to go back to.
Makes sense. We've been talking with Richard Campanella, whose new book is Cityscapes of New Orleans. You can meet him Wednesday, October 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Rich, thanks so much.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Is a place with many distinct subcultures, and a new book celebrates a fascinating one you might not have thought very much about. Poet and fiction writer Lee Grew and writer and archivist Susan Tucker have created a wonderful anthology, Mending for Memory, Sewing in Louisiana, Essays, Stories, and Poems. What an amazing history sewing has in our city. Just think about carnival costumes, Mardi Gras Indian suits, the pleasures of quilting in fabric stores, the way the craft is passed on from generation to generation. We have a lot to talk about. Lee Grew, I'm so happy to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
Well, I always listen to The Reading Life, and I'm always happy to be on The Reading Life.
Well, thank you. And Susan, you too.
Thank you. Yes, thank you indeed.
So tell me how your collaboration came about for this book.
Well, I started off thinking I was going to do a poetry anthology about sewing, because my mother was a seamstress. And then with my association with Susan, she came along with the idea, and she said, well, why don't we just do an anthology and put scholars and other writers, everything under the sun in it? And it seemed like such a wonderful idea, and we've collaborated on other projects, so this was a good one.
It's such an appealing mix of things. I mean, Susan, one of the things I learned from this book is what a long history sewing has here, how much economic impact it had, how it provided employment for women, and things like the Liberty Shop and the Christian Women's Exchange.
Yes, that was really fascinating to me, in that we could look in newspapers for seamstress ads. And one thing that was very interesting that we just have this little snippet of in the book is an advertisement for a slave seamstress. And slave seamstresses actually were sold for more money because their skills were really valued in that sort of horrible economy that they had. So we have this long tradition, and then you come up through the 19th century, you have the retention of what they call the French sewing skills. And to say that someone was a good seamstress, they would say that they were a French seamstress. And then you have other sort of small insertions into the historical record where people are talking about how domestic workers who sewed were allowed to come in the front door, whereas domestic workers who were even a cook had to go in the back door. So you have this sort of undercover history that runs throughout the city about sewing.
And one thing I had never realized, Susan, was that the Works Progress Administration, or the WPA, maintained sewing rooms. There's the most amazing photograph in this book.
Yeah, I loved finding that out, too. I came across that when I was looking for records on the WPA, actually their work in archives and how they were doing work there. But I just came across it by mistake, seeing this information on the sewing rooms. And the sewing rooms were operated all over the U.S. There were about 400 of them. And their idea was that women couldn't afford to buy their own sewing machines. Women who could sew could either sew their own clothes and their family's clothes, or they could sew the clothes for people and make money. And so we had one in the Faubourg Marigny, we know that. And we did find this picture from New Orleans of WPA sewing room. And then I found out, which was also very interesting to me since I worked with the records of Newcomb all that time, was that one of the people who taught needlework at Newcomb actually ran one of the sewing rooms in New Orleans. So that was very interesting.
Now, one of the things that is so, I think it's unique to New Orleans, maybe it's not, but I think it is, it's the whole idea that men sew here, and men prize their sewing skills. So what was that like to explore that culture?
Well, we're hoping that someone will come forward and tell us if men are sewing in other places.
But
I do think that part of it is the carnival tradition. You know, sewing is a lot like engineering. I remember as a child when I was taught to sew, my father said to me, oh, you know, it's a lot like what I used to do as a boy, because I would read all these diagrams and I'd put things together. So I do think probably it's related to these engineering skills or construction. And that is one thing that the men who are talking in the book say, that often the men who sew also do construction work. And we have a number of different essays that deal with those men sewing, and they're very varied. I mean, some men pride themselves on being able to sew their daughter's wedding gowns and their dresses for the prom, and other men pride themselves on sewing for Mardi Gras Indians, and yet other men's for the second line clubs. And the second line clubs are just so interesting. And like the Mardi Gras, it's all the time. And then what I think happens too is that this sort of talent and skill that they develop, then they can use in other ways. So there are people who are doing it only for carnival. And then there were a number of men who then went on and did slipcovers.
Yeah.
And so you think in a warm climate, we need slipcovers in New Orleans. So
yes, we do.
Yes.
I agree. Now, one of the things I loved were Arthur Pfister's pieces about sewing. I think of him, of course, as Professor Arturo, and he has written two great contributions to this book.
Yes, Arthur's one of my favorite writers, and I think anything that he does is wonderful. But that piece is so great because he talks about his mother and his sister sewing, but he also talks about the Mardi Gras Indians and all the seamstresses and sewers that he's known of different sorts. And of course, he's an outrageous writer, but wonderfully outrageous.
Always.
Always.
And very generous and extravagant writer as well.
Yes.
His descriptions are very beautiful. I think everybody needs to read his pieces too. Now, some of the very special things in this book are images. The writing is fabulous. The poems are wonderful. But some of the images bring all this to life. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about Malaika's favorite series, The Garment is the Muse. She's done some very beautiful work.
Malaika's a poet, an artist, a visual artist, and she has so many pieces in there. I mean, I don't know of anyone that has done as much talking about sewing, but at the same time showing those wonderful images. There's one in there that's a figure that has a dress on it, and I don't even know what the composition is, the materials in it, but it's incredible.
It's a dress for another poet. I remember that so vividly.
Right.
She does another one called Pepper Cain. Yeah. And she has on this wonderful, colorful dress with all these red and orange angles. And Malaika also, her poem is the last poem in the book. And we did it on purpose because she talks about sewing and how it can help us. Can it help us achieve peace? Can it help us do all these different things? And I think that that is the sensation that a lot of people have when they're sewing, is that it's contemplative and yet it's often for someone else. And so it's almost like a prayer in a way, a very detailed prayer that you're making to the world. So Malaika does that very well.
Oh, she does indeed. So Susan, why don't you read Malaika's poem for us?
Oh, I'd like to. Okay, this poem is called Threads to Mend the World by Malaika Favorite. I wore you down the cakewalk of life. I stitched my first dress by hand, pricked my fingers until they resembled a pincushion, measured and remeasured the plaid of my days. Nothing matched the mismatched dreams I had, a kaleidoscope of failed intentions hanging off my skirt like a torn hem in need of a safety pin. I styled you when the cakewalk was the fashion. My second dress was stitched on a sewing machine, pedal-pushing stitches across my aspirations. Singer, sing me a spool of red thread. I am gauging my time by the garments I made. My last dress was a string of words. I am counting all the poems I have written, lining up every word and measuring their length. Like the spools of thread that held me together, I am hemming the world with ribbons of verse. Can one poem stitched into a flag stop a war or deter the path of a bullet?
Thank you. That was lovely.
Yes, it's a lovely poem.
And I love the way you stress the fact that sewing is commemorative. You take it right up to contemporary artist Jan Gilbert's work.
Yes, that's a lovely piece because it's poet Jan Villarubia, and she's interviewing Jan Gilbert. And Jan Gilbert's grandmother was a Sicilian, and she was a seamstress in the French Quarter and then in Lakeview. And Jan talks a lot about how, as a child, she learned that sort of discipline with art through her grandmother sewing. And her grandmother could sew anything. They sewed, you know, winter coats and ball gowns and everything. And, you know, we sort of forget that in our economy today, that people were really sewing everything, not just as we think of fancy ball gowns or something. They were really sewing everything they needed.
I kind of think that we're getting an appreciation for that. Every now and then, something bubbles up, like this Georgia O'Keeffe exhibit in New York now, Living in Style. I mean, who would think she would design and make so many of her own clothes?
Right.
You know, it's a really lovely thing to consider.
Well, in a way, that too is how we chose the title, because it is forgotten and it only just pops up. So this sort of idea of mending for memory is that we wanted the sewing images to pop up in our culture for people to remember them and to carry them on. I mean, that you see a lot now on Etsy, and that those kinds of traditions are coming back.
I know. I can't tell you how many people lately have told me they embroider. It's like, really? I'm so glad to hear that. I mean, oh, we've been talking with Lee Grew and Susan Tucker, who are the editors of the wonderful anthology Mending for Memory, Sewing in Louisiana, Essays, Stories, and Poems. Thank you so much, you two.
Thank you indeed, Susan.
Thank you.
Don't miss the Louisiana Book Festival coming up this Saturday, October 28th from 10 to 5:30 on the grounds of the state capitol. It's a full day of great free events, a selection of authors in every time slot, storytelling and kids activities, and food and music, as well as a chance to get a book personally autographed by your favorite Louisiana writer. One of my favorite events is the presentation of the Louisiana Writer Award at 10 a.m. That's in the House Chamber. This year, that award recognizes author, singer, songwriter Johnette Downing, whose books from Today is Monday in Louisiana to Petite Pierre and the Floating Marsh have kept generations of youngsters reading and singing and learning about their home state. Other great authors on hand include Newbery medalist and Margaret A. Edwards Award recipient Richard Peck, with his latest middle grade novel, The Best Man, along with other children's authors William Joyce, presenting a special reissue of his classic picture book, Santa Calls, and illustrator G. Brian Karras. Many past poet laureates, Daryl Bourke, Julie Kane, Peter Cooley, will be in attendance, along with present poet laureate Jack Bedell. Julie Kane will be presenting a special group of readers from the new anthology, Nasty Women Poets. Among favorite local authors who'll be on hand are Jarvis and Kelly Harris DeBerry, Nancy Dixon, Peggy and Earl Laborde, A.C. Lambeth and Bill Lofelm, John McGill, and Maurice Ruffin, to name only a few. For more information and the complete schedule, check out LouisianaBookFestival.org. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week.
Alton Carter discusses his new book, The Boy Who Carried the Bricks, Tuesday, October 24th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. David Fulmer discusses and signs his new Valentine St. Cyr mystery, Eclipse Alley, set during the Storyville era, Tuesday, October 24th at 6 at Octavia Books, and then again Wednesday, October 25th at 6 at Crescent City Books for a signing and writing workshop. Today's guest, Richard Campanella, discusses and signs Cityscapes of New Orleans, Wednesday, October 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Chris Lackey discusses and signs his new novel, Nails Crossing, Thursday, October 26th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Ava Level-Hayman, editor of the Barataria Poetry Series, presents Nicole Cooley, author of Girl After Girl, and Martha Serpas, author of The Deaner, Thursday, October 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Susan Tucker and Lee Grew, discuss and sign Mending for Memory, Sewing in Louisiana, Essays, Stories, and Poems, Thursday, October 26th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Mark Matrana discusses and signs his book, Southern Splendor, Saving Architectural Treasures of the Old South, Thursday, October 26th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. New Orleans Stand-Up Comics presents Laughs for Literacy, Friday, October 27th at 7 at Cafe Istanbul, benefiting the Literacy Alliance of Greater New Orleans. Tickets available at the door or literacygno.org. The Dickens Fellowship continues their discussion of Our Mutual Friend, Saturday, October 28th at 2 at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. This month, read parts 4, 5, 6, Book the First, and chapters 11 through 17 of Our Mutual Friend. Ed Brantley discusses and signs Krauss, the New Orleans Value Store, Tuesday, October 31st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Coming up, Garden District Bookshop presents Chilean novelist Isabel Allende, discussing her book In the Midst of Winter with Anne Gislason, November 17th at 6 at the Academy of the Sacred Heart NIMS Fine Arts Center. This is a ticketed event. Go to Garden District Bookshop for more information. And some dates to mark on your calendar now. The Louisiana Book Festival takes place Saturday, October 28th on the grounds of the state capitol in Baton Rouge. Check out louisianabookfestival.org for information and a complete schedule. STARE, Start the Adventure in Reading, holds its annual fundraiser, the STARE Affair, November 9th. The theme this year is The Tale of Peter Rabbit. For tickets, visit starenola.org. The New Orleans Book Festival takes place Saturday, November 11th in City Park. The National World War II Museum presents the 10th Annual International Conference on World War II. That's November 16th through 18th at the museum, with 3 full days of internationally known writers. For more information, go to ww2conference.com. And congratulations to novelist Martin Poussin for winning a Penn Literary Award for his novel, Black Sheep Boy. And to Greg Heron for winning an Anthony Award at the recent BoucherCon conference. That's for Blood on the Bayou, the BoucherCon Anthology 2016, which he edited. The Historic New Orleans Collection and the Louisiana Historical Association are proud to announce Roshana Johnson's Slavery's Metropolis, Unfree Labor in New Orleans During the Age of Revolutions, is the winner of the 2016 Williams Prize in Louisiana History. And a big shout out to Tulane professor and novelist Jesmond Ward for being the recipient of a prestigious MacArthur Fellowship, otherwise known as the Genius Grant. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.